This is the Senate Energy and Utilities Finance and Policy Committee meeting agenda, or meeting January 31st, 2017, 1 p.m., room 1150, Minnesota Senate Building.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Energy and Utilities Committee Finance and Policy. Today's date is January 31st, 2017. We are meeting first in joint session with our friends from the House. Welcome, Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for having us here today.
Appreciate you being here. And yes, members that are not members of the Senate, you'll see little red switches in front of you. You do need to turn those on to speak so that we can get that on the recording, as well as amplified for the folks in the back of the room. So with that, we will begin the joint meeting on affordability of new coal technology, the Lignite Energy Council, Great River Energy, and Great Plains Institute. Would those folks come to the podium, please? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
To the chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mike Holmes, and I'm the vice president for research and development with the Lignite Energy Council.
Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members, my name is Nathan Domian. I'm a director of our generation engineering program with Great River Energy.
Chairs, members, my name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute.
Thank you. Please begin your testimony.
Again, my name is Mike Holmes, and I'm presenting first, and I'm going to focus on the research and development side of energy. And I'm the vice president of research and development for the Lignite Energy Council. Before that, I've spent 30 years doing research and development on different energy-type topics. The Lignite Energy Council is a trade organization of over 250 members related to advancing technology and keeping the existing facilities running for the lignite-fired power production. We work in collaboration. We're part of three different research divisions of the North Dakota Industrial Commission, including the renewable energy, the oil and gas research, and the lignite research. And as part of the effort, we believe in an all-of-the-above strategy. In order to be able to, we use that to be able to optimize the regional resources to get low-cost, clean, that affordable power that we all rely on. And with that, we can then baseload the intermittent sources of renewable energy like wind and solar and others. And then we can also supply that affordable energy to residents as well as the regional industry. And that, through that, we then can create jobs and affordable electricity to the residents of our region. So as part of that, to make the that a continued reality, we can look at the years of research and development that have gone into technology. Investment in technology has been a very good success for a long time. So what this graph shows, and I won't go into all the detail, but it shows since 1970 what the trends are. So this is data from the EPA and the EIA, which is the Energy Information Associate from the U.S. government. And basically some of the key points on the graph are that since 1970 through the data goes through 2014, the gross domestic product has gone up by a factor of 3.4, so a 240% increase in GDP, with the electricity going up by a factor of around 2.5. And during that time, because of technology improvements, investments, the emissions for all energy sectors, transportation, electricity, all, have gone down around the order of 70% plus. And that's because we've tackled with technology things like particulate, sulfur, NOx, trace elements, And now we're working on a lot of the projects I'll show you quickly are focused on CO2. So we continue to make investments in technologies that can continue to bring low-cost power to drive the economy and do it with a lower and lower carbon footprint and do it while enabling renewable energy to also thrive. So I'm going to skip over these and get to some of the current R&D projects that are currently being invested in and look at the new technologies that can continue that trend that we've seen. Some of the categories, and one of them I'll talk about, is a transformational technology. If you were to build a new power plant, what would the technology be that can minimize any CO2 footprint as well as keep that low-cost power? And the one we're going to present on and talk about today is there's a large investment with the industry partners and the state of North Dakota on a technology called the alum cycle. So I'll present on that, as well as technologies for enhancing the existing power production assets. And the carbon capture utilization and storage, I'll hit briefly. And then just briefly talk about the diversity of the research. It includes things like evaluating extraction of rare earth elements from feedstocks from coal-related operations, as well as advanced reclamation, so that you're returning the land to as good or better than it was before you started mining coal or doing anything else. So with that, I'm going to go into the transformational technology, and again, this one's called the alum cycle, and without getting into the details, instead of driving the power production with steam, you create and use a high-pressure CO2 to make the power production. And then on the back end, you get a storage-ready or a sequestration-ready stream of CO2 at pressure. So what they're doing now is they're developing this technology. There's a demonstration scheduled to be started up in just outside of Houston, Texas, in this summer, July of 2017. And it's a 25-megawatt electric demonstration. And we're looking at how you turn that into use of solid fuels. So instead of natural gas to fire and drive the system, we're looking at using solid fuels to create a synthesis gas and using that to drive the system. So it's just an alternate way to do it. The targets are to have near zero emissions of CO2. And in our region, we can use that CO2 to free up additional oil. And then also to get about 40% improvement in the efficiency of current systems. And then to target, as you see on the slide, on the order of 4 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. So targeting electricity rates similar to what we're used to so that we can keep from losing industry by keeping those rates down. And so the focus is on first looking at any barriers to making that technology a reality. And so we're doing a current research and development project of about $10 million on that. In parallel, they have the demonstration down in LaPorte, Texas, just outside of Houston, on natural gas, and that's a $150 million investment. And then following that, we're going to take all the data and look at use engineering and models to figure out what it would take to do a 250-megawatt commercial-scale first-of-a-kind demonstration. So that's the target for that one. And I've already mentioned that the solution is to get that near zero CO2 emissions and use the CO2 to produce additional oil. So it's a combined effort. And I just briefly want to put up one slide and talk about the geology in our region. So a lot of investment has gone on in this region for looking at how the geology is set up to store CO2 for long term, and the answer is the geology is really good, and not only that, the oil and gas opportunities are incredible. We have, for several decades, we have enough storage capacity in just the conventional oil wells if we were to use the CO2 for additional oil for transportation fuels. If you look at the tight oil, the Bakken it's called, the estimates are that we could use that opportunity for an additional 2 to 3 billion tons of CO2 storage, so way more than we would ever have CO2 available from power production. And then we can extend that opportunity for oil and gas up to a 5-generation type opportunity. So there's plenty of opportunity to help the economics of carbon capture and storage by using it initially for the oil opportunity. So the next one is something, and the Minnesota utilities have been key to all of these types of projects that have gone on throughout the Lignite Energy Council's R&D program. This one happens to be called Project Tundra, and it's a way of looking at capturing CO2 from an existing facility and then storing that CO2. So it's a bolt-on capture facility to an existing facility. So it's called Project Tundra, and it's being driven by Minn Kota Power and Elite Clean Energy are two of the main people, as well as BNI, Clean Coal, North American Coal, and others. And so if you look at this and the path forward, they already have one, just went into operation in January commercially down in Texas. This is looking at taking the capture technology to our region and moving it that next step so that you can further reduce the cost of the first of a kind being demonstrated down at Texas. And you can look at some of the unique properties of our coal and our opportunity for utilization of the CO2. And the goal is to get this driven by the economics of the value of the CO2. And then while you're producing that oil, you are storing that CO2. So this is just a little visual of how it works. You bolt on the capture plant to the back end, capture the CO2, clean it up, and then you store it in the geology and produce additional oil. And this, similar to the other one, we have the roadmap, the timetable, and the next step is to go through those engineering studies and models to fully understand the economics, reduce the risk, and get ready for a large-scale application. So those are pretty much the two I wanted to focus on. The last slide here just shows some of the diversity. We have a whole suite of other different projects that range from everything to returning the land to better productivity than before the mining occurs. And you're going to hear next about one that Great River Energy does that looks at improving the fuel before you utilize it. So with that, if there are any questions, Chairman or members of the committee, I'd be happy, or I can turn it over and wait till the end.
Thank you. I think it's best for us to try and take questions as we go through each testifier. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the testifiers. Two questions. So number one, you mentioned in your presentation regarding the alum cycle on CO2, but what about the other emissions, NOx, SOx, mercury? What's the expected emissions profile of those items?
So as with the current fleet, we have the regulation requirements for these emissions, and we would go beyond. The SOx and NOx are easily taken care of in the technology once it's proven commercial. The high-pressure nature of the system makes them want to come out into and be absorbed into a scrubber, similar to what Coal Creek does for Great River Energy. Only the high pressure makes it even easier.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, so right now we basically have two different options for no carbon or low carbon energy sources. Nuclear, which has the problem of spent nuclear fuel. Wind and solar, which have problems with intermittency. So if you're able to produce this energy with no carbon footprint and you're able to do it at a low price, I mean, why would we not do this?
Sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, that's a very excellent question. And as well, the answer is The only thing stopping us is the investment into the technology development to get it to that point where you reduce the risk because of the large investment in a commercial application. And you nailed the intermittency challenges, and some of these types of units are critical to being able to base load the wind and solar so that we can keep growing those portfolios. We need the base load technologies like the plants with carbon capture that can cycle as we have intermittency.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for these nice seats. Nice over here in the Senate. The question that I have for you is, as we have seen in Germany, they've had some very unique struggles with their renewables and also with trying to phase or to move away from nuclear power. In response to that, as you probably know, the German government, they're building 10 new lignite power plants. And this is also, it seems to be the pattern now after Fukushima in Japan. We've also seen this in South Korea and Australia and Poland as well. My question to you is, are any of these advanced technology nations, or is anyone else doing this anywhere else in the world?
Chairman and members of the committee, very excellent points and questions. The rest of the world is, especially if you look at China, India, and some of the other regions that are developing, are putting in new power plants faster than we can imagine. And so the investment is needed for places like Germany that are seeing that challenge and pushing the renewable portfolio to the point that they have the brownouts and the challenges so they lose the reliability. So a lot of the other places in the world are starting to look at these types of technologies some, but they are putting in power plants way faster than looking at the technology. But your statements very much emphasize the need for technology investments because the CO2 footprint we have in a single power plant is nothing compared to the amounts that, you know, you would see in China and India with the rapid growth in their economy. The other thing I think you've pointed out and is very important is we need to keep looking at some of these examples like Germany and learn from what they've done. And the National Coal Council had a presentation on that and a study. So if anyone would like to follow up with me, I can get my hands on that and share that. But it looks at the problem of storage once you get to a certain level of renewables.
Representative Neuberger? And in answer, Ms. Representative Neuberger, for $90 million, the chairs better be comfortable. So, any further questions for this testifier? And we will move on to the next. State your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, thank you. My name is Nathan Domian. I'm director of our Generation Engineering Group in Maple Grove, Minnesota, for Great River Energy. Great River Energy is a generation and transmission company that is owned by 28 member cooperatives that are in Minnesota and northwest Wisconsin. We are tasked with providing them with the generation plants and the high voltage transmission systems up to their distribution substations, and then they take it from there to their members. I better pull up the presentation first. There we go. What I'm going to do here, this is a picture of Coal Creek Station. This is our largest coal-fired plant located about an hour north of Bismarck, North Dakota. It's a two-unit, 1,200-megawatt lignite-fired plant. I'm going to talk about a technology called dry fining. This is a technology that some innovative and intelligent people with my company have patented, and it's today a commercially available technology that's working at this plant that is improving coal before it's burned at two of our plants, this plant and Spirit Wood Station, which is located near Jamestown, North Dakota. So, again, this is a technology that involves the innovative use of waste heat that's otherwise exhausted to the atmosphere, that is not of sufficient quality or energy to be transformed into electricity from traditional power plant technologies, but it is good enough to heat air in this, to heat up air that is used to segregate and dry the coal at this plant as lignite. So through these two improvements, through segregation and drying, we're able to reduce air emissions, coupled with lowering O&M costs and increasing the efficiency of the plant. So I'm going to briefly touch on what that is in the next few slides. So if you go to slide number two, this is a visual of a traditional coal plant and is representative of Coal Creek Station. So if you look on the left side of the graph, you can see what the primary things that dry finding is doing. It's lowering the moisture in the fuel, so we have to burn less coal to get the same amount of electricity out. It is also a contaminant removal device, and I'm going to talk about that in the next slide, but it basically is a density segregation device that takes pyrites, clays, dirt, rock out of the coal before it's ever burned and turned into ash. These pyrites also have much higher levels of sulfur and mercury in them, and before they're ever consumed, they are taken out and put back in the ground where we found them. And so this is unique in that you don't see a lot of technologies that are, one, commercially available, and two, reduce emissions and increase efficiencies and reduce O&M costs. So it's kind of a win-win-win for existing and new coal plants. The waste heat that's used to heat up the air, that's used to dry the coal, is basically heat exchangers that are put in the ductwork that you see here that is lower grade, that is, you know, to heat up air to about 280 degrees. And that 270 degree air, is pushed across the coal to dry it. This energy, like I said, would otherwise be wasted. How it works. This is kind of a mass balance of and talks about the two major components of the coal drying. There's the actual coal dryer and the air jig. If you look on the top left-hand corner, you'll see 100. This is a diagram showing 100 tons of coal right out of the coal mine, and this is a mine mouth coal plant. So the mine is right adjacent to the coal plant. That's why the coal plant's there. If you look at the red dots and the black dots represent the coal. That's the stuff we want to burn. Compared to the red dots there represent the contaminants, the pyrites, the clays, the dirts, the rocks that we want to get out of there. The fluidizing hot air that's taken from waste heat comes up through the bottom, and you can kind of think of it as an air hockey game. That fluidizes the coal and will lift it up over a weir that's taken out as a dry finding product. That hot air is also taking 9-10 tons of moisture right up a stack and never sees the boiler. That segregated coal, and you can kind of see as it goes into the air jig, there's still a little coal in there as well as a number of contaminants. That goes to an air jig where another segregation process takes place, again, using density separation where air is brought in underneath and further refines that coal so the contaminants get taken out and the coal is reprocessed and brought to the boilers. That's the technology that we have patented and that we are marketing across the world. Two-thirds of this world is living in Southeast Asia and China and is primarily building new and counting on low-grade coals to electrify their countries. And we are marketing this technology. If you look at the bottom right, that's an actual picture of one of the dryers at Coal Creek Station. So in terms of its impact, emissions impact, we're taking out 10% of the moisture, we're burning 10% less coal. We're taking, lignite is typically about 40% moisture. We're reducing that to 28 to 30%. Through doing this, through taking out the pyrites, the segregation of those contaminants, plus improved collection efficiencies in the existing scrubber, because you are tasking them less, we are removing 54% less SO2 with this technology than before. Again, with mercury, the segregation of the ash minerals, those contaminants, plus improved collection efficiencies with the technologies we have there, we have seen a 40% reduction in mercury. By reducing the fuel, the volume of the gases, the air and fuel in the boiler itself, we're able to basically get better fuel-to-air ratios and reduce our NOx emissions by 32%. And with the 4% cycle improvement efficiency, we're reducing CO2 emissions by 4%. And this is coupled with a 20% plus million dollars in annual savings in operation and maintenance costs. And that's basically you're overhauling your coal mills less. You've got less, all of this less basically ash to get disposed of. There's just a lot of less wear and tear, a lot less parasitic loads on your fans and your mills. All of this is being done. So it's not just something that reduces emission. It also helps the economies of the scale and lower your cost of electricity from this facility. If you look at efficiency improvement, this is an EPRI report, which stands for Electric Power Research Institute. It's a peer-reviewed kind of renowned energy R&D center. And this report shows the various technologies that you can use to just improve efficiency. This has nothing to do with emissions, but this is something just to get a better efficiency. And you can see the third one down there, the low-T fuel drying, which is basically dry fining. Low-temperature fuel drying is what that stands for. And most of the other technologies here, especially the higher efficiency ones, are basically you're putting in a whole new boiler, a lot higher pressure, ultra, supercritical kinds of things. This is on a sub, Coal Creek is a subcritical plant, which is a lower pressure and temperature plant. And so a lot of those things are just at an existing plant, just are not feasible from an economic perspective. This can be put on existing plants, this can be designed into new ones. So, and lastly, this is my last slide before any questions and answer, any questions you may have. We are actively marketing this. We believe that this is a technology that can be used at existing plants in the U.S. and across the world. We have marketing agreements with Black & Veatch currently, which is a large engineering and architectural firm. And we're in discussion with other OEM manufacturers of energy production equipment to really show them the value of this technology so it can be used and recognized by others. We are going around to various conferences, journals, articles. We're going all around the world trying to market this stuff and show the advantages of dry fining. It did win dry fining. Did win Project of the Year from Power Engineering back in 2010. So it's been recognized as, you know, an effective way at an existing power plant or a new power plant to reduce emissions and increase efficiencies. Thank you. I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Domian. Domian. Questions from the panel? Seeing none. We will continue to the next testifier. Please step up, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute. And just give me 1 second to get my slides up. Not advancing. It's not advancing on the screen. What am I doing wrong?
Give it a moment. It's thinking.
While we're apologies for that. I'll just go ahead and get started here. I'm with an organization called the Great Plains Institute. We are a mission-driven organization. Our mission is to transform the way we produce, distribute, and consume energy to be both economically and environmentally sustainable. We work in several ways. We try to develop better energy policy through consensus, through working with all the stakeholders and finding common ground. We support adoption and development of new energy technologies, and we try to provide reliable analysis information and reports. Throughout our work, you know, we work on a lot of strategies to increase the use of renewables and energy efficiency, but we do support a portfolio approach to our energy system, and we do unambiguously see a need for carbon capture technology as part of a portfolio of energy technologies. So we do work nationally with stakeholder groups on policy to advance carbon capture from power sector and industrial sources. So why do we see this as so important? Well, there's a few reasons. There's a few challenges that suggest a role for carbon management in our energy system. One of them is the difficulty of reducing emissions from certain sectors, for example, certain industrial emissions. Airlines, for example, would be another source. We would predict that there's going to continue to be a role for fossil fuels and a need to manage the carbon from those sources over time. And a lot of analysis suggests, although that we could deploy a lot more renewables, there will be challenges at very high levels of renewables. It's unclear exactly what that threshold is. You know, people talk about 80%, but it could be, we can debate the number, but there will be at some point at which you still do need a role for base load or any intermediate load generation. And that a lack of carbon management can make it more expensive to sort of manage some of the changes that are happening in our energy system. You know, sort of looking out into the future, we also anticipate a need for technology that actively removes carbon from the atmosphere. And there's a lot of strategies here, a lot of ways we could do that through using plants, soils, but, you know, carbon capture fits in with many of those strategies. And so the question becomes sort of those are out there in the future. What can we do today? And I think we look at carbon capture in the look at it the same way we look at a lot of things like, you know, watching the evolution of wind or solar over the last 40 years. You see this every time you double manufacturing capacity, the cost declines. And so that's why we've seen the cost of wind drop precipitously, the cost of solar, the cost of energy storage. And we're going to see that same kind of pattern with carbon capture technology. And to me, this should justify increased research or continued research and investment in deployment. The question comes about what do we do now? And so we look at, you know, with the economics we have today, what are some viable ways to move this technology forward? So utilization of carbon, finding, instead of thinking of carbon as a waste product, think of it as a raw material or as a something that has value that people are willing to pay for. One of those things is enhanced oil recovery. So there are, we have a long track record of this in the United States, not in Minnesota. We don't produce a lot of oil here. We do produce a lot of CO2. But we have over 40 years of experience with enhanced oil recovery. The process is you inject CO2 into a mature oil well that's not producing. Most of the CO2 actually stays in the ground. You get more oil in the process. There's actually more CO2 being stored than that's being produced in the oil. And importantly, you're helping to build out a pipeline infrastructure for CO2 management that will be available for you in the future, whether or not you're doing EOR in the future. We have thousands of miles already of CO2 pipeline in the U.S. We've produced over a billion barrels of oil through this technique. It's about 4% of U.S. production. And one of the things, kind of looking out into the future, a lot of that pipeline infrastructure is in Texas and Wyoming. We do some of this happens in Michigan. North Dakota has been a leader in this technique as well. We're partnering with Saskatchewan. But we have a lot of sources in the Midwest, and you could imagine a pipeline infrastructure that could extend nationally and draw Minnesota into the mix and help manage sources in our state. A lot of those green dots are ethanol plants, which happens to be you can pretty cheaply manage CO2 from ethanol plants, and that can become a new value stream. I just want to mention here, it would be a whole separate presentation to talk about some of the federal policy in the carbon capture space, but we do work with a national coalition to promote some policy at the federal level. I just wanted to put this up to note that this is a very bipartisan issue. So we were working on a Senate bill in 2016 that included, on one side of the aisle, Mitch McConnell. On the other side of the aisle, people like Senator Booker and former vice presidential candidate Senator Kaine. So again, strong support from both sides. I think recognition that this is an important strategy for our energy system. And I think one of the few issues at the federal level that it has enjoyed bipartisan support. We do see ethanol as this is a really intriguing opportunity for ethanol. These oil companies will pay ethanol plants for their CO2. Archer Daniels Midland has a well-known carbon capture project in Illinois, where they've captured and stored over 1 million metric tons in deep underground. There's several ethanol plants in Kansas that sell CO2 to oil producers for enhanced oil recovery. A lot of ethanol plants just sell CO2 for food and beverage, carbonating drinks, that sort of thing. Another connection to Minnesota, I don't want this to all be about Texas. So 3M actually, I asked them if they would mind. I'm not an expert on this, but I got a tour at their pilot plant, and this is a pretty interesting project. They are figuring out how to make energy and materials out of CO2, and it could be CO2 that they capture from the atmosphere. It could be CO2 from an ethanol plant. It could be CO2 from a power plant. But they have technology for taking CO2, combining it with renewable electricity, and making synthetic hydrocarbons, so making oil or gas or materials from CO2. So they look at this potential to make kind of everything we're making out of oil or natural gas now out of CO2. Another kind of interesting angle, and it just shows that this technology can develop in unpredictable ways and can provide benefit that we don't anticipate up front. One of the things 3M is looking at is, can we take CO2, produce liquids or gas, and basically use it as an energy storage strategy? So, maybe if the wind's blowing at night and nobody's using power, you could make natural gas, put it into the natural gas grid, and then use that to, balance that variable renewable resource. I guess my closing comment would just be that, we do feel like a portfolio approach is important. We support increased deployment of renewables and energy efficiency, but we also support managing carbon from both renewable and fossil sources of energy as part of a kind of a balanced energy system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the other Mr. Chair. And I look at the other Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, you guys were part of that Lehigh Institute, and I believe the discussion on carbon capture was spent there. And I see you, Brandon, I've heard your Mr. Jordan, this presentation many times, and I see Kenrick's in the audience, too. The conversation surrounds around I didn't see much about the Saskatchewan project where the sulfuric dioxide that turns into sulfuric acid, which then some of the fly ash. And I guess, if there's any kind of return on investment that you see within this capturing moment that you had, I noticed you didn't have that, but if you could talk about that as well as, the topography in Minnesota. It's my understanding that we don't have the topography for carbon capture within Minnesota. So unlike Texas or, again, Saskatchewan, they did it because they don't get sun and they get too much wind, but not enough sun. And so this was one way for them to look at lowering their carbon dioxide. So can you just kind of comment on that, if that's a fair question? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen. So what I'm most familiar with on the North Dakota and Saskatchewan side is the Weyburn Project, which is a project, and I think my colleagues can probably talk more about that, but it's a, a project where they capture CO2 from the Dakota Gasification Project. It's really interesting, 1970s era, Carter administration era gasification project, and they pipe CO2, I don't know, 100 miles or so up to Saskatchewan and do enhanced oil recovery in the Weyburn oil field. I'll address your second question, and maybe some of my colleagues here on the stand would have more to say about the Weyburn project. But it's true that Minnesota does not have, or that we're aware of, much geology that would be favorable for storage. However, we would have the ability to take CO2. We produce plenty of CO2, and if there are ways to turn it into liquid fuels or other things, we could do that here. And I think we also have the ability to, if we're going to build a national CO2 pipeline infrastructure, to make sure those pipelines serve Minnesota and that there's a, opportunity for producers of CO2 in Minnesota to be part of that system and generate revenue if that is possible.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you. As a follow-up, the proximity to that and the infrastructure begs the next question. And I know, like in Texas, when they built their new coal plants, they had put the carbon dioxide capturing and was right there next door, and they were doing all their making of the ash from that side of it. So if you envision Minnesota doing that, how do you see us? I mean, there's got to be an issue with some infrastructure. There's going to be a cost associated with that. I just am trying to wrap my arms around, this isn't Texas, this isn't Saskatchewan, this is, a different set of guidelines here. So how do you envision seeing that?
Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, there are some proposals floating for multi-state pipeline projects. I think it would just require Senator Hoffman. I apologize.
No. This is Mr. Chair. This is actually pretty fun to be called Senator Cohen.
I do apologize for that, Senator. Trying to recover here. That was a bad one. Oh boy.
That's okay. He forgives you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman. it would be a multi-state build-out, and there are some proposals for multi-state pipeline projects.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to make a comment today how exciting this is to see this great new technology and the efficiencies that we can bring to talk about the real new future of clean coal. I'm very excited about that. I just wanted to make a comment to our colleagues here, and again, thank both chairs for bringing us all together today. This is how we should be doing this. I want to thank Senator Marty for helping me start to work on the SIP program that I think we need to update here in Minnesota. We've had the conversations that the SIP program, the Conservation Improvement Plan, that was started some 25 years ago needs to be updated. So I just want to say that I really welcome these kind of conversations and looking at what we can do now today with today's technology to continue to work with this, because, again, what you're doing here is exactly what we're talking about. So I just want to say thank you for doing this.
Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Jordan, I just have a question on how safe is it to manufacture and distribute these synthetic gas? And, we've had a lot of issues in the news lately about pipelines, and I was just curious what your take is on that with this technology.
Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, members, I think it depends on what you're producing, of course. And I would imagine the goal would be to produce something that's chemically the same as sort of what we use now. So I would think that the same safety requirements that would be in place for natural gas or gasoline or diesel would apply to a synthetic version of the same product.
Representative Mullery. Or, I'm sorry. Who's next? I think Mahoney. Sorry, Mullery Mahoney. Sorry, Representative Mahoney. I got the M right.
You know, as a senator, you start out at a certain level with meeting, and you didn't help.
That didn't help.
I have a number of questions, Mr. Chairman. What's been the total cost? Can anyone tell me on the clean coal research that we spent on? I know there's been fits and starts over the last 15 or 20 years. And the reason I ask the question is I there's a comparison between when the research done on solar and the research done on wind energy, which is our two primary renewable energy sources. I'm just wondering what we've spent at this particular point on how to burn coal again. Who wants to take that one? You both, all of you look like you're going like, oh, I don't know.
Mr. Jordan or anybody who wants it.
This is Mike Holmes, Chairman, members of the committee. I can't give you a historical summary of how much. I can tell you current numbers over the last decade have been roughly, because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but roughly about 25% of the renewable research budget is how much goes into the fossil energy budget.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much CO2 is, we make a lot of it, like a lot of it. How much of it is resaleable and where would it be resold to? You've mentioned carbonated beverages, you've mentioned a couple others, but are we, so how much do we make? How much of it is resaleable? Where do you sell it to now? And are you going to be able to sell it all in 10 years?
Mr. Holmes?
Yeah, Chairman and members of the committee, that's a very challenging question because it depends on where you're located. So we need technology investment to move things forward, but we also need those first-of-a-kind demonstrations. And in our region, we have the opportunity to, as was just stated, make the CO2 a commodity with value. And so in our region, we have enough oil and gas demand, especially as the Bakken gets developed, where we could utilize basically all the CO2 that we could produce for many generations. And then after that, again, the oil and gas activity is down about 2 miles in geology that's held natural gas for millions of years. So it's a very good, sound geology. So there's other geology down there, saline formations where you could store order of magnitude plus additional CO2. But in the meantime, we have a commodity value that outsizes the actual supply of CO2 available in this region. Now, that means that we would have to, again, for Minnesota plants, get the infrastructure in place, as was stated, so the pipelines could get it to those formations.
Representative Mahoney.
The nice thing about CO2 pipelines is that they should be less controversial because when they leak, you just get Pepsi.
Yep.
That's right.
Earlier, and I don't remember who it was that brought this up, but you were defining coal as coming back for a baseline energy source.
Yep.
And you threw out some numbers, and I wasn't quick enough to write them down. Could you expand on what you think, what role it would fill? I mean, are you looking at going back to the 1950s with baseline coal providing 90% of our energy, or are you going back to a couple of years ago when it's down to 10, 20, 30, 50%?
Mr. Holmes? Or Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have I can't put a number on it. There are a range of studies evaluating the sort of how much renewables we can put on the grid, and some of it just comes down to what are you willing to pay. But so I can't put a number on it. I think there's a lot of studies that suggest we can put quite a bit more renewables on the grid cost effectively. But at some point, you do run up against some challenges. One of them is you don't just have variation during the day in something like wind or solar production, but you also have annual variation, which becomes much harder to manage and store. So again, what I guess I would suggest is it's probably not a, in your words, going backwards. I think it's defensible to say that there could be a lot more renewables on the grid than there are right now. But there might be an upper limit, and there might still be a role for, I believe there's still a role for base load, providing, you know, as a portfolio, part of the portfolio.
Representative Mullery? Mahoney. I did it again. Sorry. I apologize.
You are not helping yourself.
I know. I am not helping myself. Representative Mahoney.
You know, you're just going to get me to vote for this, for some bill, so I can be on a conference committee with you and take it even.
Whatever it takes, Representative Mahoney.
And here's my problem with the technology, and I've been a technology guy since I got here, from the sciences to the biomedical and everything else. And, you know, I've asked a series of questions here trying to get to some answers. And the problem is that when you have a technology like this, when you're doing research, you don't have a really solid answer. Because those are things, if you're looking for help from the state or to change someone's attitude, you really need stronger answers to them. Now, I haven't picked on the engineer at all, but I've been in a coal plant or two in my lifetime, and you deserve to be if you've ever designed one of those things. But my core question here is, when do we get a few more solid answers so that we can make more reasoned decisions here rather than just say nice things to each other? Do you have an idea as when that's coming?
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there is more information regarding some of the questions you've asked. I know I'd be more than happy to come in and try and come armed with a few more specific facts and figures about some of your questions regarding, what's the amount of baseload that's needed in the system? What's been the level of investment? What do we expect in terms of cost reductions for carbon capture technology? I don't have all those things right at my fingertips right now, but I would be more than happy to discuss them offline.
We have time for two more questions. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I wanted to comment on a couple of things here real quickly, one of which is that we talk about, I visited the GRE thing, and I think it's nice to see the 50% reduction in SO2 and 40% reduction in mercury. There are still problems. But it's good that we're doing that. It's good they're pushing the technology. That's very important. And carbon capture is important as well. And I think we ought to be exploring that every way we can. However, the Great Plains slide talks about how we're not going to be selling that much carbon dioxide for carbonated beverages. We wouldn't have a problem with greenhouse gases if we had enough carbonated beverages to use it. We're talking about the one example it's been used for is to store it underground and use it to produce it. And the Great Plains slide suggests instead of carbon capture by doing it, they say we're going to put out about as much CO2 in the oil as we are there. So in effect, we are not really capturing it there. We're capturing part of it and replacing it with putting more out. And when we have carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, 400 parts per million, when we do have, we may not want to admit it, but I don't remember 30, 40 years ago having a lot of rainy days in the wintertime in the Twin Cities. Things are changing, and they're changing very quickly, and we're going to have to address it. And these new technologies may be good for bits and pieces along the way, but if we're talking about a huge new carbon dioxide piping system around coal-fired plants, that's generations of, well, that's decades at least before that could come into a widespread thing. That doesn't address the rest of the mercury problem, the SO2, the NOx, everything else. Very expensive, and we don't have that kind of time as we're continuing to put more CO2 in the atmosphere. And the only illustration I've heard that sounds like it's a reasonable market for CO2 now is the storage underground and using it to pump out more oil. And that's a carbon exchange in effect. So I just think we got to keep all that in perspective, because you're talking billions of dollars in investment over decades that don't solve the problem. And I think, Mr. Jordan, I'm sorry, I think the idea that we're going to have significant baseload power, fossil fuel power, 3 decades from now, I don't think it's going to be there. I think you're just wrong.
Senator Hoffman, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now that Senator Marty brings up the – when I was 10 years old, I remember it was 110 below wind chill out in Hollywood Township, and, you know, the post-traumatic stress because of that. You know, now I'm going to have to go see my therapist, John. I'm sorry. I was trying to be funny, and it's not funny. But I forgot one question, Mr. Chair, because we're talking about the infrastructure, and if you're looking at some type of build-out, I guess the question to the panelists are – are there federal or state subsidies right now, you know, for the clean coal? And if there are, can you – I guess I don't understand. Can you tell me how much? I mean, is that a fair question? If there's federal state subsidies, how much does that look like?
To any of the three testifiers? Mr. Holmes.
Yeah, Chairman, members of the committee, there are state R&D programs so that if you – have a small-scale demonstration, you can get federal support for that to help leverage, the funding that we have going towards research in the states, as well as the industrial support. But then, when you get to much larger demonstrations, like the Dakota Gasification Plant was mentioned, and they send about 2 million tons of CO2 up for permanent storage a year. And that, way back then, had a much larger federal support to make that happen. So when you get to the 100-megawatt type scale, those commercial demonstrations, that funding is not currently in place to get federal support at those types of levels. It's much smaller. And the pipelines we're talking about, just to answer an earlier question, for their couple million tons a year, that's a 10-inch diameter pipe because it's pressurized to the point where it acts more like a liquid, the CO2.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just then, thank you. It sounds like yes and no. So it maybe we could have research or somebody, you know, get that information. So it sounds like there are federal and state subsidies. It would be kind of nice to know as this conversation goes on just, you know, how much those subsidies are. And it sounds like there's some kind of methodology behind getting those. So I would ask that, please, Mr. Chair, if you could.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Yes, we'll have staff follow up with the testifiers and check into that for you and get back to the committee. With that, members, we have some business to attend to with the Senate committee. And at this point, we will go to a short recess while we set up for the Senate meeting. We are stand in recess.
Thank you.
If everyone will take their seats, please. We are back from recess. This is the Senate Energy and Utilities Finance and Policy Committee for January. I wish it was July 31st, 2017. Before we start, I do want to go over some ground rules. These are general Senate ground rules as far as activity that happens during hearings. We want to be respectful. We do not have public outbursts. If there are public outbursts, those individuals will be removed from the room. That is for either side of this equation. We are here to hear testimony and get through as much testimony as we can. In this particular bill, because there are many people who are opposed to that or are on the list for opposition, we're going to give the author of the bill and his support group or support individuals 15 minutes for their presentation, another 15 minutes for opposition, and then any questions from senators with the remaining amount of time. We have approximately 35 minutes, but we do want to be equal with both sides, but we will take a vote on this at quarter to three and recess at that point in time. Any questions from committee members? Okay. Senator Weber, welcome to the committee. This is Senate File 141, and we do have a quorum present.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for me to be able to be before you and present this bipartisan bill, Senate File 141. Relatively short bill, but in essence what it really does is is exempts our municipals and REAs from having actions brought to the PUC concerning their purposes. I think as a result of what we have seen in our communities, having served 16 years as a councilman and mayor and running a municipal electric business within our city, having seen my co-ops in action, I think that we have to recognize that, quite frankly, they are responsible to the ultimate authority, and that is their customer, because their customers elect them, elect the board of directors, elect city councils and mayors, and as a result, that made me comfortable in bringing this bill forward. The one thing that I do wish to comment on is that this bill in no way, shape, or form changes net metering rules and regulations as they exist, and nor is it intended to. And I think at this point in time, so that we may have efficient use of our 15 minutes, I am going to turn it over to Jim Horan at this point, and please introduce yourself for the committee.
Mr. Horan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Horan from the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, representing the state's 45 distribution co-ops and 6 generation and transmission co-ops. I wanted to start off by telling you what this legislation isn't and then explain what this legislation will do. As Senator Weber mentioned, this legislation makes no changes to net metering, will have no impact on solar in Minnesota. Cooperatives will continue to follow the laws they have since their creation by local communities over 80 years ago. This makes no changes to the grid access charge, which is authorized by the legislature in 2015, and that has very specific requirements in statute. Those specific requirements limit the size, scope, and variability of that charge. The uniform formula developed by the cooperatives goes even further, taking into account the impact of the specific DG facility and not charging anything on the first 3.5 kW of installed distributed generation. The grid access charge, again, not changed in this legislation, was implemented by the cooperatives and clearly meets the statutory requirements and will be collected regardless of this legislation. This legislation has nothing to do with net metering. It merely clarifies a section of statute, bringing it in line with what the rest of the utility statute does as it applies to the relationship between the Public Utilities Commission and local democratically regulated utilities. I'd like to provide a quick example of what this legislation would do in practice. Let's say a member doesn't like an interconnection charge at a cooperative. The responsibility for the interconnection cost, the charge, along with what can and cannot be included in those costs, is clearly stated in statute. The member who doesn't like the cost goes to the cooperative. The cooperative provides an accounting and rationale for that cost. Now, if the member still doesn't like the cost, one of two things happens. If the member believes the cooperative is violating the law and they can't resolve the issue through the cooperative's dispute resolution process, the member can request the Attorney General's office intercede. This is the same as under current law. The PUC cannot take legal action against a violation of the law. Now, if the member thinks the cooperative should socialize some of the legally recoverable interconnection costs, and the member can't convince the regulatory board to place his interests above all others at the cooperative, the member should rely on the democratic process, and that's what this bill is about. Working to convince his fellow members that certain costs should be socialized and paid for by all members regardless of how they use the system. This process has worked well for cooperatives and municipals for over 80 years and should continue to apply here. Cooperative boards, as democratically elected regulators, are constantly striving to put members' interests first. However, putting members' interests first doesn't mean giving every member exactly what they want. The democratically elected regulatory board balances the interests of all member owners of the cooperative. The current statute needlessly asks the Public Utilities Commission to balance again the same interests that have been locally regulated within the law. That duplicate of regulation is unnecessary, costly for member owners, and only serves to second-guess their local decisions when providing no benefit. Please support this modest request for regulatory reform and continue to put your trust in local decisions for local communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horan. Members, we're going to go through the remaining two testifiers. If we have additional time in the 15 minutes allotted for Senator Weber, we'll ask questions at that time as well as in the remaining time after the opposition has their moments or their time on in front of the panel. Next is Linda Leilat. Sorry. I'm bad with names today. Leitala. Please, welcome to the committee. Please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Linda Leitala. I'm elected director of East Central Energy Cooperative, ECE is located in Bram, Minnesota, and serves over 59,000 members, all the way from the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities up to the outskirts of Duluth and into the rural areas surrounding Superior, Wisconsin. Directors of East Central Energy are elected for 4 years. And while we are responsible for the member owners of our cooperative, I represent a district within that of nearly 9,000 members, 8,970 to be exact. As an elected director, I have a fiduciary responsibility to our cooperative to ensure that we provide the essential services that to balance the interests of the members fairly and that we collect the costs needed to operate the utility. We support and promote clean energy. We work closely with members who purchase wind turbines and solar panels to ensure that they are safely installed and grid ready. To date, our members have interconnected 53 solar and 14 wind turbines with our system. We also offer members the ability to purchase cow power or electricity generated from methane gas, which we purchase from a farm near Princeton, Minnesota. Last year, we held our first ever EV evening, an electric vehicle demonstration in Bram. We had electric vehicles from 5 different manufacturers at that event. Lots of questions, lots of members. Electric vehicle ownership in our territory is growing, and ECE has responded with multiple EV rates that are tailored to meet individuals' needs. We also have a staff of 4 working with business owners every day to help them operate in a more energy-efficient manner. We offer rebates for commercial members for energy-saving projects such as lighting, HVAC, motors, and drives. In addition, we offer low-interest gap financing loans for economic growth in our area. ECE encourages our employees to be involved in their communities, and we invest in area youth by offering scholarships from funds derived from unclaimed capital credits. In the 10 years that I've been a director, we've averaged $60,000 a year in scholarships. As an elected director, I'm directly responsible to my member owners. I know many of the owners by name and in my district personally, and I hear from them regularly with their questions, their comments, their concerns, and their complaints dealing with the business of our cooperative. ECE regularly surveys our member owners, asking a range of questions dealing with rates, power supply, programs, and service options. And then we share these results with our members through our locally produced at ECE newsletter, The Advantage. We have a website that lets members know about the new programs and of outages in their area. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We have an annual meeting open to all members. Our CEO encourages questions and comments from members in an open forum. In addition, we have 4 annual customer service events every year spread throughout our service territory. This is to show our members that we appreciate their business and we want to hear what they have to say. The constant focus on member feedback and member engagement is because we are member-owned. Our members drive every decision we make. The current regulatory process is unnecessary and only adds costs to me and to my fellow member owners in time and money. Please support the local democracy legislation and continue to allow member-owned cooperatives to make member-focused decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee Tala. We have approximately six minutes remaining in this time. Next is Deb Erickson.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity. My name is Deb Erickson, and I'm an elected member of Minnesota Valley Electric Cooperative located in Jordan, Minnesota. As an elected director, I've represented Minnesota Valley for over 7 years. There are 45 distribution cooperatives in Minnesota, and we are similar, and yet we are all different. We provide affordable electricity, and we all are locally regulated through a democratically elected board. The size and demographics of our cooperatives vary greatly, from rural agricultural areas of the state to the lakes and then the metro region. No two cooperatives are the same. It is through our local regulatory process that we balance the needs and wants of our member owners within the law. Our right to be locally regulated enables each cooperative to provide their member owners the energy programs that are desired for their cooperative. Whether it be a community solar garden, energy efficiency program such as demand response or load management, or perhaps a community solar project. Now, as a democratically elected director, a member of a member-owned cooperative, I appreciate and I understand the role of the Public Utilities Commission. I follow their meetings and I respect their opinions and decisions. Their role is necessary in working with the investor-owned utilities and the delicate balance between the ratepayer and the investor. However, with a member-owned cooperative, the ratepayer and the investor are one and the same, and I am one of them. You see, this is why the cooperative business model works. It places the interest of our members first. We have a system of checks and balances. When differences of opinion arise, our process ensures that those interests are heard. As directors, we are available to our members. If they have an issue or a concern, they are able to contact us directly, and they do. We listen, and they are allowed to advocate their position on anything impacting them. All requests are listened to. In addition, any member can run for our board. This ultimately gives the power to the members to determine the future of the cooperative. This is how cooperatives have ran for over 80 years. I, along with my fellow directors, take our regulatory role serious. We focus on being responsive to our members' interests and needs. At Minnesota Valley, we focus on providing energy information and innovative programs to our members. We provide our members access to daily electric usage information on their bill. We provide all our members access to daily and hourly electric usage information via our website and a smartphone app. Our members can then use that information to determine which actions they would like to take and what MVEC programs they can participate in to optimize energy usage. With over a dozen programs, our members have a vast array of options to choose from in managing their energy profile. Over 40% of our members participate in such a program. This seems to be meeting or exceeding our member needs. I think this is really interesting to note. Our cooperative consistently scores 89% on the American Customer Satisfaction Index. By comparison, the average investor-owned utility scores a 72. We are innovative, we are responsive, we are locally regulated. The cooperative business model works. Please eliminate this unnecessary duplicative bill.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. We have about 2 minutes remaining in this portion. Are there any questions for these testifiers that we could take right now? Senator Senjan.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just to the board members, do you have any just recollection of complaints or disputes that individual members would have brought to your boards? Just a couple. I just want to get a sense of what kind of complaints members might have.
Probably best for...
I can answer that. We've had questions on rates, complaints on rates, and as a result, we have changed some of our rates to make them more fair. We've also had questions on time of service.
Got time for one additional question. Anyone on the panel? Okay, hearing none, we will take the opposition individuals. We have 15 minutes, again, allotted for that group. I'm going to call up, at the chair's prerogative, some on the list here, some interesting, so to get a dynamic of different viewpoints rather than having all farmers show up like farmers. But in this particular case, we need to have a lot of other perspectives. Glenn Jacobson, an attorney from Sacred Heart. Jim Nichols, a farmer from Lake Benton. And Sam Villia, I'm really lousy. He's with Conexus Co-op. He's a member of Conexus Co-op. Okay. With that, we will start with Mr. Jacobson. Please welcome to the committee and please state your name for the record.
Glenn Jacobson, and to correct the agenda, it's spelled with an E. I'm an attorney. My farm is near Bird Island in Renville County. I work for the county as a county prosecutor. I have a wind turbine that I've had for 9 years. I'm scheduled to install 19.5 kilowatts of solar this spring. As an attorney, as a prosecutor, as an ordained minister, and as an Eagle Scout, I'm as trustworthy a person as you can find in this room. I am subject in everything I do to review and oversight by the court I practice in, by the Court of Appeals, by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and beyond that to the United States Supreme Court. I see no reason why my rural electric cooperative cannot also be subject to review and oversight by the Minnesota PUC. If they are, in fact, acting in my best interest in making fair and appropriate judgments as far as rates and fees, then that will be borne out by a hearing at the PUC. What they are proposing to do is to remove my ability to ask for an independent review and to submit for a decision by the board of the electric cooperative, who are the same people that made the decisions to impose the fees in the first place. And I want that review process left intact.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Mr. Nichols, state your name for the record.
Can Paige hand this out, Mr. Chairman?
Paige, can you hand out the written document?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll talk fast.
Thank you.
We're on a short schedule here. The very first page that you will see, the page out of our contract with Xcel Energy, and we're generating power for 3.35 cents. On the next page, and that's locked for 25 years, on the next page you will see that, and the next two pages, I'm paying 17 cents, 14 cents, 16 cents to my local REA. Now, I have met with my local board several times. I've discussed this several times. I'm also the chief author, when I served here, of legislation that removed the REA co-ops from the PUC. That was in 1978. A lot of things have changed since then, and I'll talk about that very quickly. It doesn't work as well as it used to, but they're good people, and I especially like our chair, Sandy Luneman. The Luneman family is a great family, and you all know Cal, and I've known them for all these many years, and a very good farm family, and we've all farmed out together and had good success for many years. But back to the problem that we have. In my discussions with my board, they have pretty much adamantly refused to purchase any wind energy locally in Minnesota. Basin Electric does have two wind farms in South Dakota, but the cost, as you can see there on that second page, if you have it in front of them, they're paying 6 cents per kilowatt hour to buy coal in North Dakota, and the price gone up. I just got another price increase, and I want to send that, my January bill, to you, Mr. Chairman. And they have refused to buy wind energy in Minnesota. Now, it's created thousands of jobs in Minnesota. We generate, I'm a county commissioner. My county alone receives $1 million in property tax payments, which I think you should consider when you pass this property tax bill, because those of us counties, and there are 10 of us, that receive a lot of income from the turbines, and I did help write that law when I was a member of the Senate Tax Committee. So it's been the best thing that's ever happened to us out there in southwest Minnesota. And now I know they're going to tell you that this costs them so much money for these payments that they have to make. We have only 13 farmers in Lincoln County that use alternative energy, and the total payment to them is $6,255. If you're concerned about payments when you can buy wind for half the price, why would you not address the $3.6 million that we're now paying to buy coal, and we pay our manager $185,000 a year? And that's fine. My point is that this $6,000, and they've used this many times, that it's costing them so much money. That's just not true. And, Mr. Chairman, there's a good next one about two, and is a very good comment by Representative Joe Schumacher, who is my representative, and Senator Weber's my senator, because he's been very good on this issue. And as he said there, we need to support wind energy development in Minnesota. And we certainly do, Mr. Chairman. And for some reason, my REA co-op refuses to do that, and that's the problem that we have. They are free from oversight, and by law, I have to buy my energy from my REA co-op. I would love to use the energy that I generate for 3.3 cents, but I have to go to my co-op and pay 17 to 16 cents per kilowatt hour. And it's going up, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, we're right now building. We've got a lot of wind energy in southwest Minnesota. Right now, project that's going up right now, the north end of the Lincoln County where I live, They're going to create 200 temporary construction jobs. It'll generate $425,000 in local spending, motels, food, a little bit of beer once in a while. It'll generate $24 million in payments to farmers over the next 20 years and $17 million in tax payments. It also creates 12 permanent jobs. We now have 15 jobs in the county, Mr. Chairman. They're all permanent jobs and good jobs. Thanks to Wynn.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Next up, Sam. Pronounce the last name. I'm lousy today.
That's okay. Sam Vallela. Thank you, Senators, for allowing me to testify today. I am a Conexus Energy member owner. In 2009, I put 9 kilowatts of solar PV on my roof. I did that as a hedge against future rate hikes. At that time, electricity was about 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Since that time, we've gone up about 50%. We're at 12 cents a kilowatt hour and change. Out of the blue, in 2014, Conexus started charging me a monthly, what they called net metering fee, which I thought was not legal at the time. In 2015, the law came specifically allowing such a fee, but they've been charging me that before this law change happened. I thought this is a clear violation of the law. I currently have a rate case pending at the PUC. It's docket 15-755, and I'm hoping for, you know, satisfaction in that reason. You know, I certainly attempted to go to the cooperative, and they were not. There's nowhere. You know, it is what it is. They had it set their way. I'm also here to speak that at least my cooperative is not as democratically run as everyone thinks it is. In the elections, only 7% of the people actually vote. I ran in 2 consecutive terms unsuccessfully to try to get on my board. The only people that are elected to the board are incumbents, and they are designated so on the ballot. When someone leaves for whatever reason, usually death, basically they are they appoint somebody from the public at large, and then that person runs as an incumbent. So it doesn't really happen that somebody just decides, I'm going to run for the board and gets elected. At least in my memory there, no one has ever been elected that's not a non-incumbent, or that is not an incumbent. Also, the rate cases that have gone before the PUC, there's been 3 recently in the last couple of years, have all come with decisive victories in favor of the complainant and against the cooperatives. And, you know, the testimony is riveting, and if you watch the PUC, I would encourage everyone to watch the video. You can go to the PUC site and look them up. The 3 cases were Alan Miller versus Peoples, Larry Fagan versus Minnesota Valley, and Keith Weber versus Meeker. This removes a key oversight. I don't have say in who I get my power from. It's a monopoly. And the only recourse that I have for a disagreement right now is with the PUC, and you're taking that away. I don't see that as favorable for the consumer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Vallela.
Vallela.
We will call up three additional testifiers right now. We have about 7 minutes left in this segment. We will go with Logan O'Grady with Clean Energy, Michael Allen with All-Star Solar, and Alan Gleckner from Fresh Energy. And we'll start with Logan O'Grady. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. For the record, I am Logan O'Grady, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Clean Energy Economy, Minnesota. We're an industry-led nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening and growing Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. We represent and work with industry to educate the public and decision makers on the business case for clean energy and how strong public policies have had and can continue to have positive, lasting impacts on our state's economy. Today, we have brought just a few of the hundreds of solar businesses from all over the state that employ thousands of hardworking Minnesotans in good-paying jobs. The homegrown businesses you'll hear from today would be negatively impacted by this proposed legislation. I hope, Mr. Chair and members, that after hearing their stories, you will be as inspired as I have become by their entrepreneurial spirits, their innovative leadership, and most importantly, their dedication to their employees. I urge you to continue the tradition of support you have for them as we work to build a flourishing clean energy economy here in Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll get out of the way so you can hear directly from them.
Thank you. Next up, Alan Gleckner, Fresh Energy. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, have a handout, too, for the page. It's a list of the current cooperative fees that are in place against solar and wind customers right now in front of the PUC. This comes from an MREA filing. Thank you for giving me the chance to testify today here. I'm Alan Gleckner, the Director of Energy Markets for Fresh Energy, an independent nonprofit that provides in-depth research and analysis of energy issues in Minnesota. While the bill language itself may seem tame, this bill would have a significant negative impact on property owners across greater Minnesota. In essence, this bill is an attempt to allow co-ops free rein to charge a small set of their customers new fees as high as $83 a month. For some context, and as some of you may remember, the co-ops were here in 2015, passing a bill at the very last second of session that authorized them to charge limited fees on customers who exercised the right to generate their own electricity. A key piece of this 2015 legislation was that it included boundaries on any fees, most importantly that they are reasonable and based on the co-op's cost of service study. However, since then, 20 co-ops have proposed what amount to the highest fees on these customers in the country, as high as $83 per month. Moreover, the fees are not based on actual cost of service studies, use an inaccurate method to calculate the fees, and include absolutely zero accounting for the benefits brought to the electric system when customers invest in solar and wind systems that offset expensive electricity investments that the co-ops would otherwise need to make. The Public Utilities Commission is reviewing these new fees to make sure they're fair and consistent with the co-op's own 2015 law at the request of co-op customers who have invested their own money on their own property for homegrown energy. Now the co-ops are back here again, this time to prevent their customers from having independent review of these fees or of any future co-op action regarding customer-owned electricity generation in the future. The very fact that the co-ops have proposed exorbitant fees that ignore their own legislation demonstrates why their customers need this last resort for neutral expert review. And the co-ops know that their fees won't stand up to independent review, and so that's why they're here today to make sure that a fair review doesn't happen. Many co-op customers tried to work with their co-ops management and boards for a reasonable solution and have been almost universally shut out. After investing thousands of dollars into their own property and supporting energy businesses in greater Minnesota, we feel co-op customers have the right to question fees up to $83 a month and have them reviewed by someone other than the co-ops themselves. Simply put, if co-ops are allowed to design and run the only dispute resolution opportunities for customers, the legislature will have removed basic safeguards that protect customers and protect the freedom to generate their own electricity. Again, while this language here may seem benign, this is a classic case of the fox wanting to guard the henhouse. Rural Minnesota utility customers deserve better than that, and you should stand up for them by opposing this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gleckner. We have about 2 minutes left. Mr. Allen with All-Star Solar, please, or another representative.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marty Morud, owner of True North Solar in Edina, Minnesota. You know, this bill is about price competition and consumer choice. We've seen solar installations costs go down 40% in the last 6 years. That's driven a lot of interest of Minnesotans wanting to go with this new technology. But now we're facing a time where we're unfairly able to compete that technology against others because of the uncertainty in these fees and solar taxes coming along. How do we have a fair market, open market, level playing field with that much uncertainty in the future? That leaves zero opportunity for the customers to make a fair choice. They have a right to that choice, and they cannot make it fairly without understanding and being made aware of these taxes and fees in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We are at the app. We've got about 30 seconds if you could make it back. Sorry to be that quick, but we're trying to get
it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Michael Allen. I'm with All Energy Solar, based here in St. Paul. I'm going to make some pretty quick points here. The PUC asked co-ops and munis how many solar systems they've installed as of September 1st, 2016, and that number was approximately 900 systems. Of those 900 systems, 170 of those are working with our company. We have a very good understanding. That's approximately 20%. We have a very good understanding as to what's going on with municipalities and with co-ops right now, and we have an enormous amount of complaints To date, we have over 25% of our co-op and muni clients have voiced a variety of complaints. And I think it's important to point out a couple of them, if you give me just a moment. First one, we submitted an interconnection application over a year ago. We've had three city council meetings, and we still have gotten nowhere. Our intention is to file with the PUC. We have another utility in northern Minnesota near Duluth that told us that we couldn't install solar panels unless our customer installed a full battery system, and that was going to increase the customer's expense by over $15,000. I'm not going to go into the third. By voting to approve House File 141, you'd be making a poor business decision. You'd be ignoring your clients' issues and stripping them of any rights that they have to a fair resolution of conflict. Instead of avoiding these issues by just eliminating your constituents' opportunity to a fair hearing, we must face them directly. Let's come to a fair conclusion on how to have solar and all utilities work together so that we can move on and continue to build a stronger Minnesota economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. The time has expired for the opposition. We're going to bring this to the committee itself and have some questions here. Then if there are any amendments, we can entertain them. Before we start, I did have one question for, I think Mr. Horan can answer this one. There was a fee bandied about up to $83 fee. Can you explain a little bit more about that large fee being imposed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm a regulatory attorney by training, so I can go into great detail on how we've gone into meeting the statutory language that was passed in 2015. But the short answer on that one is the $83 charge comes from a co-op that has a fixed charge, the fixed charge being the cost to serve that member before they buy or sell a kilowatt hour of $98. So $98 is what that utility needs to recover to keep the lights on. The $98 pays for the poles and wires. Their delivery charge, their monthly delivery charge is $15. So the $83 is the difference between the two of those. And so they're only collecting $15. They're collecting the rest of it in the variable rate through a variety of rate designs. But that $83 is a cap, and the $83 would only apply to large-scale systems. We're not talking about the average rooftop system. We're talking about a 40 kW pad-mounted ground system, a larger system, would only apply to that size of a system. And again, it really is going to be dependent on that individual co-op and how they react to it. But the average, well, we ran this for the numbers across the state for co-ops, the average dollar amount on this charge, on this grid access charge, was $3.10 a month. So not $83, $3.10 a month, and well within the law. And I'm happy to go into excruciating detail with you on the cost of service studies and everything else that went in. We spent months and months with rate experts working on that to put that in place.
Thank you, Mr. Horan. And for other testifiers that were on the list that did not testify before the committee, you're encouraged to have written testimony added to this record. You can certainly send that to my office or to my committee administrator, and we can certainly have that included. Questions or amendments from the committee? Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not an amendment, but I guess I have some real concerns about when this bill came in a couple of years ago, we did not have discussion of it. I don't know that there was much in the House, and there wasn't here, not much of this, and it was meant to be, and the law says I think it's reasonable and appropriate charges. And I guess my concern is, yes, they're saying one of the board members was saying they're democratically elected, but, you know, even in a corporation has minority shareholder rights. You can't say, well, because we're in charge, we can unfairly stack the deck against certain shareholders, in this case, certain members. And I guess I have real concern that in this case, because it's a monopoly business, that we are basically saying nobody, in effect, saying the complaints have to be resolved through the co-op. It does strike me as they are the judge, the jury, everybody else. They're the ones setting the rules, and they're the ones determining if the rules are fair. And I guess I have real concern, Sarah Weber, about the idea that we're taking away this. I mean, it was required to be reasonable and appropriate charges, and here, who determines it? The co-op board. I guess that strikes me as a good way to put out of business a lot of these small installers. I don't know how many there are. I don't know how many are making money of it, but obviously, we've had a lot of them come here wanting to testify. That's my concern.
Senator Weber?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, I think that you, in listening to the description that Mr. Horan gave as relates to the charge in question, you know, there has been a system then and formula that has been developed, and I think that in that scenario, you know, there are guidelines, there are definite guidelines to be followed, and I think earlier comment that Mr. Horan had made, you know, if there is a disagreement and concern regarding the final decision, they are also able to call the Attorney General's office and file a complaint there.
Additional comments and questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Weber. I appreciate the conversation that Senator Marty raises, and that's the kind of the crux of what I talked to you about prior to this, was that there is still some concerns regarding the alternative dispute resolution, or in this case, the dispute resolution, and some of the assurances that are there. And so I guess the question goes to you and to Jim, is there any leeway or any ability for you guys to go back to some of the concerns that came out under the dispute resolution process within here? Because, yeah, we can file a complaint with the Attorney General's office, but then there's a timing issue on that. And I'm wondering if there's are you willing to sit down with folks and have a little deeper conversation about, you know, if there's a win-win within the alternative dispute resolution process? And if so, how about can we do that?
Mr. Horan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, we would be. I'd be happy to look at that. My question, and I think I talked to a few of you about this, we have this kind of two-prong approach. Either you have an issue because you think the utility isn't following the law, and in that case, the Public Utilities Commission doesn't offer you the solution. Only the Attorney General's office can take legal action. If you don't like the decision, the balancing that co-op board has done, the co-op board's authority is actually slightly broader than the PUC's authority in this case. The PUC can't balance any more interest than the local board can. So how to do that without getting into this issue of duplicative regulation or unnecessary regulation where you don't like the local balancing, so you take it to your forum shop, to a different court, and you ask them to take a different take on it that isn't going to be as local. The decision within the law is going to be the same. The same issues are going to be balanced. You can't look anywhere outside of it, but you're asking a different court to look at it, and that's the issue we've got because that has been abused in the past. But I'm happy to be open to sitting down and talking about it always.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Horan, for being willing to sit down and do. You might want to, in the spirit of Father Fabian, you might want to bring that Venn diagram and figure that one out. But I appreciate your willingness to sit down and talk to folks. So with that, I just want to say thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I won't repeat the concerns articulated by Senator Marty and Senator Hoffman. I share those. I would just ask Senator Weber a couple of things. One is, given the testimony that was offered by the opponents about the nature of those who succeed at getting elected to the co-op boards, is that a concern you share? It's something I've been aware of for quite some time. And Mr. Horan talks a lot about the balanced interest and how fair and democratic and democratic and democratic, yet the only people who seem to get elected are those who are already picked by management. I know a number of folks who have tried to get onto co-op boards and have not succeeded. You know, so there's clearly something wrong with the elections process. So that's one question. I have a second.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, at the same time, I know individuals in my home area who have been defeated as they sought re-election to the Board of Directors. So it does happen. You know, is there a proverbial benefit to incumbency? I imagine we've had that debate as relates to judicial elections in Minnesota, and we can even talk about our own seats in that regard as to what benefits are there. Like I say, I do know that in the case of local co-ops in my particular area, I do know individuals who have been defeated in their effort to seek re-election.
Follow-up, Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think
few too many incumbents for defeated to our body last year.
Well, Senator, I don't know if I agree with that one, but
thank you. Well, you know, I think it's an issue worth examining and worth analyzing. Did Senator Jungbauer run for the Conexus board? Anyways, then the second is you know, of course, you know, we saw the hookup charge or the maintenance fee. Some of these are quite extraordinary. And so, you know, I'm curious about the nature of the design of the ongoing fees, you know, for folks who want to have distributed energy at their homes, and, you know, particularly with respect to solar. Wondering, do co-ops as a rule, I hear a lot about the cost and the burden and the hassle and et cetera, and, you know, maintaining reliability, et cetera. So a lot of the downside, but I don't hear a lot from the co-ops about the upside of solar, the benefits, the proverbial value of solar, capacity, economic development, environmental values, reliability and resilience, and you know, as a hedge for future fuel costs and the like. You know, how much of that is factored into this?
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, before I turn the microphone over to Mr. Horan, I will mention that you know, there are definitely sites in rural Minnesota where you have large livestock producers that have put solar panels out to utilize for their own their own needs, and with the excess going on into the system then. And so, you know, there certainly are instances where that is being done. And as far as to on a statewide basis, I would need to defer to Mr. Horan in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. I'd just also like to state that we need to stay to the bill itself. It does not specifically have an indicator that this has to do with solar. It has to do with the regulatory authority that the cooperatives have. So I do want to somewhat stay focused if we can. I know that there's bleed over, but just to stay to the bill. Mr. Horan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'd be happy to talk offline and actually with anybody to go through the detail on what we went into this cost recovery charge. Co-ops, about two-thirds of our co-ops in the state have community solar gardens. There's a lot of interest in the value of it on the system, a lot of investigation into that side of it. We're working closely with our members, obviously, to see what the members want on it, but we're also seeing, as you mentioned, about the resiliency and reliability of solar on the system. So we're investigating it. The cost recovery charge is really that. It's focused on cost recovery. And so we looked at that. We looked at the value of solar, and I'd be happy to talk more with you about that offline to keep it in time.
Thank you, Mr. Horan. Senator Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comments are going to be a little bit about more about process, and I'll keep them very brief. And I have a whole another list of questions and things that we could talk about the actual content of the bill. But as I listen to the testimony today, and I think we've all had visitors over the last couple of weeks coming to our offices and talking, you know, on both sides of this bill, quite frankly. And one of the things that I'm reminded of as we're trying to hurry up and get to the end here, and I admit I did come from the other body, so I'm just working on getting broken now, but
you know, we forgive you for that, Senator.
But this hastiness of trying to pass this bill, I just wonder about that. And so my question is for you, Mr. Chair. We had a list here of about, you know, 17 or 18 folks that had signed up to testify, and you heard a number of those, and we appreciate that. And I think I heard you give the opportunity for those that had signed up to submit perhaps written testimony to the committee, and we'd see that, which I think we all appreciate. But I think from the public's perspective is about transparency of government, right? I mean, there's one thing to say we can look around the room here and we can count votes and we can see where this bill is going to go, but it's a whole other thing when we say, you know what, we're just going to run out of time here. We're not going to be able to take the public testimony. And when I look at this list, Mr. Chair, members, I mean, there are small business owners on this list. There are farmers on this list. A lot of these folks are just, you know, average citizens that want to weigh in, and I personally would like to hear their testimony. But in the absence of that, in the absence of that, Mr. Chair, because we are going to take written testimony, I think is what I heard you say, I'm wondering if you would be so kind as to consider laying this bill over or tabling it. Let us take the time to absorb some of this testimony that's going to be provided. You know, just today we had a few testifiers that handed out a number of materials that I haven't had the chance to look at. And I just wonder, in the terms of transparency, if you would consider that.
Thank you, Senator Simonson. I think I would entertain coming back later this evening. Actually, Senator Weber's committee meets in the next 5 minutes in this chamber. I'm not sure, Senator Weber, if you have an agenda, if you're actually meeting today. If you're not, we suddenly have the room.
Mr. Chair, we actually are having a hearing today in our committee as relates to the Palmer amaranth invasive weed issue in Minnesota agriculture.
Senator, do you have a time estimate on how long you think you would be using the chamber?
Well, we anticipate our normal time going from 3 to 4:30.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a pension commission tonight, so I will be unavailable. I do know, does this bill go anyplace else besides this committee?
Senator Rosen, yes. This bill also will, or this next stop for this bill is in finance. So I think there is additional opportunity for testimony to be taken there. And I think the sample that I took from the list here is rather fairly representative. There may be additional comments that individuals may have, but I think we've heard from owners, we've heard from farmers, we've heard from actual co-op individuals. I think we've had a fairly representative sample, and sometimes testimony can be rather repeated considering the names or the types of people that are on the list. So I think we've probably had a pretty good sampling of it. And we've also received, I'm sure you've received by email, significant traffic on this particular issue itself. So I'm rather adverse to carrying this over because I think you've had a representative sample. Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the co-op folks. In regards to the cost recovery, does that dollar amount or what you come up with include power outages, maintenance on your transmission lines, your equipment that's on the system? And does this also include buying back the excess energy that's generated by these solar or wind farms?
Mr. Horan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goggin, the charge is focused on fixed costs, so some of those costs in terms of the fixed costs, the poles and wires would be included in it, but it does not have any impact on net metering, the retail rate reimbursement of net metering. So no, we're still paying back retail rates to DG developers. That isn't affected it at all in this.
Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you're talking the fixed costs, does that include, like, if we have a snowstorm and you lose a power line, does that get reflected back into these recovery costs from the providers?
Mr. Horan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goggin, not really, no.
Senator Goggin.
So you pick up all that cost yourself and that's not passed on to the consumer?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Goggin, yes, that is, yes.
Charitable, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Goggin. There are any amendments from committee members? Seeing none, there's been a roll call requested. Roll call granted. Senator Rosen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 141 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Rosen has made the motion to pass the bill and recommend it, and pass it to Finance. Further discussion? Hearing none. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Osmek?
Yes.
Vice Chair Matthews? Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Goggin?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Pratt?
Yes.
Senator Rosen?
Yes.
Senator Senjum?
Yes.
Senator Simonson?
No.
The total is 6 yes and 4 no. The motion prevails.
On a vote of 6-4, the bill passes and is recommended to the Finance Committee. Seeing no additional agenda items, Thursday members, we do have two bills on the docket, and at that time we'll take them up. This meeting is now adjourned.